From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Bestialidad!
The bestiality of imperialism, a bestiality that knows no limits, that has no national frontiers. The bestiality of Hitler's armies is like the North American bestiality, like that of Belgian paratroopers and that of French imperialists in Algeria.
This is in Argelia.
Che Guevara, the Latin American revolutionary, was killed 40 years ago today. Commemorations are being held across the Americas. We'll hear Che Guevara in his own words and consider his legacy with Latin American history professor Greg Grandin. But first, former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan on missing billions of U.S. currency in Iraq.
It's certainly not brought to my attention. I frankly find it very unlikely that those orders of magnitude were involved in any of the numbers that we were dealing with.
Greenspan said he wasn't aware of the missing currency, but investigative journalist Donald Bartlett and James Steele, who wrote the expose on the missing funds, will join us to respond. All that and more coming up. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has vowed to remove half of Britain's troops in Iraq by next spring. The drawdown will reduce the number of British troops from 5,000 to 2,500. Gordon Brown made the announcement before Parliament.
He's already assuming security responsibility. We expect to establish provincial Iraqi corps in Basra province in the next 2 months, as already announced by the Prime Minister of Iraq, move to the first stage of overwatch, reduce numbers in southern Iraq from at the start of September 5,500 to 4,500 immediately after provincial Iraqi control, and then to 4,000, and then in the second stage of overwatch from the spring, and guided as always by advice of military commanders, reduced to around 2,500 troops, with a further decision about the next phase made then.
Britain originally sent 45,000 troops as part of the initial Iraq invasion. Gordon Brown has said there is a possibility that all British troops would be out of Iraq by 2008. While Brown addressed Parliament, thousands of anti-war activists gathered outside to call for the immediate withdrawal of British troops from Iraq and Afghanistan. British MP George Galloway warned that Britain should not allow the United States to drag into a war with Iran.
So I say to those MPs who are able to go into the House of Commons, you better tell Gordon Brown to make up his mind, to stand up and say no. Not one single British soldier or military asset will be lent to George W. Bush for any war with Iran. Thank you very much indeed.
Iraqi authorities are calling on the U.S. government to sever all contracts in Iraq with the private military firm Blackwater USA within 6 months. Iraq is also seeking $8 million in compensation for each of the families of the 17 Iraqis killed last month by Blackwater guards in Baghdad. Iraqi lawmaker Omar Abdul Sattar accused Blackwater of creating chaos in Iraq.
This accident has revealed this case, but if this accident did not happen, we would not know anything about it. How many people have Blackwater and others killed? I do not know. I think that there are many security firms, there is security chaos, and the Iraqi citizen has become a target for everyone.
Meanwhile, the Los Angeles Times has revealed that the widow of the Iraqi vice presidential guard killed last year by a Blackwater employee has yet to receive any compensation. The Iraqi guard was fatally shot while on duty in Baghdad's fortified Green Zone by a drunk Blackwater employee named Andrew Moonen. After the fatal shooting, Moonen was flown out of the country. He was never charged with a crime. 2 months later, Moonen reportedly returned to the Middle East to work for another private military company, Combat Support Associates. And the New York Times is reporting congressional Democrats appear to be backing down from promises made 2 months ago to roll back broad new wiretapping programs granted to the National Security Agency. A Democratic bill to be proposed today in the House would impose some controls over the NSA's powers, but would give the government broad blanket authority for wiretapping. Kate Martin of the Center for National Security Studies said, quote, "This still authorizes the interception of Americans, international communications without a warrant in far too many instances and without adequate civil liberties protections. Senate Democrats are drafting a competing proposal that might retroactively grant immunity for telecommunications companies that took part in the NSA's warrantless domestic spying program. Meanwhile, the Federal Communications Commission has announced it will not investigate whether Verizon, AT&T, and other telephone companies handed over customer phone records to the government as part of its domestic surveillance program. FCC Chair Kevin Martin cited National Intelligence Director Michael McConnell's claim that such an investigation would pose an unnecessary risk of damage to the national security. The military junta in Burma has indicated pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi will remain under house arrest for years to come. A state-run newspaper has suggested in a commentary that she would remain detained until a new constitution is in place, a milestone that could take years to achieve. Meanwhile, the Burmese military has appointed a government official to act as a liaison between Suu Kyi and Burma's military generals. This comes as the Guardian newspaper reports the Burmese government has shut down some of the last communication links between Burma and the outside world. Exiled dissident groups in neighboring Thailand say the Burmese government has seized up to 10 satellite telephones and countless computers that had been smuggled into Burma. The military junta had already shut down the internet and blocked mobile and fixed-line telephones. The British and U.S. embassies in Rangoon are now impossible to get through from outside the country. A prominent member of the American Psychological Association has resigned from the organization because the APA continues to condone psychologists' work on interrogations at Guantanamo and CIA black sites. Mary Beth Shin is a former president of two APA divisions. She also criticized the APA leadership for discouraging dissent from its interrogation policies. Meanwhile, the psychology departments at two Quaker colleges, Earlham College in Indiana and Guilford College in North Carolina, have passed resolutions calling on the APA to change its interrogations policy. Psychology professors at Earlham are urging other departments to pass similar resolutions. In campaign news, the former actor and U.S. Senator Fred Thompson will be participating in his first Republican presidential debate tonight in Dearborn, Michigan. On Monday, Thompson announced Vice President Dick Cheney's daughter, Liz, would co-chair his presidential campaign. Former Virginia Senator George Allen is another co-chair. Last year, Allen lost his re-election bid after he referred to a young man as a macaca at a campaign event. In other campaign news, Republican presidential candidate Congressman Duncan Hunter has claimed undocumented workers are being rounded up and forced to illegally vote in the United States. He said, quote, "We have right now a real danger of people that are illegally in the country being rounded up, herded into the polls. We've seen that in California, voting illegally. That disenfranchises everybody in that community." The gay rights advocacy group Service Members Legal Defense Network is demanding the Pentagon conduct a full investigation into the death of a lesbian soldier in Afghanistan. Specialist Kiara Durkin of the Massachusetts Army National Guard was found dead from a gunshot wound to the head on September 27th. Her sister, Fiona Canavan, said, quote, "She told us that if anything happened to her, we were to investigate." According to the Service Members Legal Defense Network, Durkin is the first openly gay GI to be killed in Afghanistan or Iraq. In Colombia, the Bogota newspaper El Tiempo is reporting a 12-year-old girl has accused two U.S. soldiers of sexual assault and rape. The men reportedly met the girl at a disco and brought her back to the Tolemaida military base. Charges have not been filed against the soldiers. The Colombia Support Network has criticized an agreement between the U.S. and Colombian governments that prevents Colombian officials from prosecuting crimes committed by U.S. military personnel in Colombia. Newly classified documents reveal the U.S. Army once explored the potential for using radioactive poisons to assassinate important military or civilian leaders. According to the Associated Press, the program was approved at the highest levels of the Army in 1948. The documents give no indication whether a radiological weapon for targeting high-ranking officials was ever used or even developed by the United States. And today marks the 40th anniversary of the death of Latin American revolutionary Ernesto Che Guevara. Born in Argentina in 1928, Che rose to international prominence as one of the leaders of the 1959 Cuban Revolution that overthrew dictator Fulgencio Batista. Che later aimed to spark revolutionary activity internationally. In 1965, he led a secret Cuban operation aiding and training rebels in the Congo. 1 year later, Che was in Bolivia, helping to lead an uprising against the U.S.-backed government. On October 8, 1967, Che was captured by Bolivian troops working with the CIA. He was executed 1 day later. Commemorations are being held across the Americas today. On Monday, Bolivian President Evo Morales paid tribute to Che.
Who could ever consider themselves to be his successor? It is impossible to eclipse the life of Che. Nobody could do that. One could consider themselves the successor of Che only if they give their life for humanity. While we are still alive, we could never consider ourselves the successors of Che.
We'll have more on the life of Che later in the show. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Juan Gonzalez with Amy Goodman.
Welcome to everyone online, listening to the radio, and watching on television. As we return to a story we just recently covered, Iraq's missing billions. Just weeks after the invasion of Iraq, the Bush administration began airlifting plane loads of cash to Baghdad for use by U.S. occupation officials. $12 billion in U.S. currency was shipped in just over a year. But where did the money go? To date, at least $9 billion cannot be accounted for. Last month, Democracy Now! Interviewed the investigative journalist team, Donald Bartlett and James Steele. They published a shocking expose in Vanity Fair tracking how the money went from the Federal Reserve to Iraq. Well, 2 weeks later, the former Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan appeared on Democracy Now! For a debate with the journalist Naomi Klein. In our interview, I asked Alan Greenspan about Bartlett and Steele's piece. I wanted to ask you about, well, a piece by Jim Steele and Don Bartlett that came out in Vanity Fair, where they're talking about the billions lost in Iraq. And they begin their piece by saying, between April 2003 and June 2004 in U.S. currency, much of it belonging to the Iraqi people, was shipped from the Federal Reserve to Baghdad, where it was dispensed by the Coalition Provisional Authority. Some of the cash went to pay for projects and keep ministries afloat. But incredibly, at least $9 billion has gone missing, unaccounted for, in a frenzy of mismanagement and greed. Alan Greenspan, when you're head of the Federal Reserve, how much knowledge do you have of this? And did you investigate this? Were you aware of this at the time?
Well, let me say that what we were involved in was essentially endeavoring to create a viable currency for the Central Bank of Iraq. And what we did do was, I think, very successfully create what is a viable financial system, even under the circumstances that currently exist. There was, as far as I can judge, a huge drain of the resources into areas which nobody to this day can understand or follow. It had nothing to do with the central bank and in our relationships with them. We were merely acting as an intermediary to assist them in creating a system which they now have, which is working reasonably well despite all of the problems that are going on. The issue which you're referring to had nothing to do with the Federal Reserve and any of our relationships with the central bank.
Well, they're talking about, in one day, for example, the East Rutherford Operations Center of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, 100 Orchard Street in East Rutherford, a tractor-trailer truck pulling up. And though accustomed to receiving and shipping large quantities of cash, the vault had never before processed a single order of this magnitude, $2.4 billion in $100 bills. But ultimately, again, $9 billion of $12 billion gone missing in Iraq.
I am not familiar with any such evidence, and I certainly, it's certainly not brought to my attention. I frankly find it very unlikely that those orders of magnitude were involved in any of the numbers that we were dealing with. You have to make certain that there's been a lot of confusion about losses, and people have used the dinar, the currency unit of Iraq and assumed they were American dollars. And, of course, that gives you a highly distorted view. There's been, I've seen several reports fairly recently in which that sort of mistake was being made.
Well, this
but all
is
I can tell you is that no such numbers of any order of magnitude of the type you are discussing came to the attention of the Federal Reserve.
This is based on that award-winning article in Vanity Fair, or the team who have won.
Award-winning doesn't necessarily.
Well, I mean Jim Bartlett and Don Bartlett and Jim Steele, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. I'm sure you know their work. But Naomi Klein?
Well, I would just add that it's quite surprising, actually, that Mr. Greenspan is unaware of the scandal around Iraq's missing billions, because Paul Bremer had to testify before Congress and was asked directly about those missing billions. It's been the subject of very high-level investigations. There's a huge paper trail around it, so this is hardly a secret, and it's hardly just a matter that's confined to Vanity Fair. This is.
Well, I'm not saying that the losses are not real. I think they are, because obviously we can't account for all the oil revenues. I'm just merely saying it's not something which was directly related to any of the actions which the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, to which you're referring, was involved, as far as I know.
That was the former Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan speaking on Democracy Now! Last month. For response, we are joined by that Pulitzer Prize-winning journalistic team, the authors of the Vanity Fair piece, Don Bartlett and Jim Steele, two of the nation's top investigative journalists, joining us from Philadelphia, where they live. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jim and Don. Don, why don't you begin your response to the former head of the Fed, Alan Greenspan?
Good to be with you, Amy. One of the problems is that Mr. Greenspan speaks in a language that is unknown to most of us. He's done this for years in a kind of economic doublespeak, which goes unchallenged. But in this particular case, Mr. Greenspan is flat wrong. Jim obtained a lot of this information, which came from Mr. Greenspan's Federal Reserve Bank.
I mean, one of the things it's hard to decide where almost to begin to talk about this comment of his. He talks about confusion. One of the most significant things that's part of this whole process, the fact that they don't know where this came from, where these numbers came from, all of these came numbers from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which is a, if not a branch, it's certainly a part of the Federal Reserve System, which Chairman Greenspan headed for so long. And the Federal Reserve Bank of New York provided these to various U.S. government agencies, various congressional committees. There are literally thousands of pages of documents that led to the statistics that we used in our article, which was that basically $12 billion was shipped in this 14-month period. And on the one day in particular, you mentioned the $2.4 billion. All of that is out of records of the Federal Reserve System. So the Federal Reserve System certainly was intimately involved in processing this cash from the very beginning. Once it got to Iraq, which is the point we made in our story, that's where everything vanished, where there was absolutely no oversight, where there was no follow-up. And the idea that this went into creating a viable system over there is almost comical, because when you look at some of the records in Iraq, you see that much of this money went to the Ministry of Finance, which in turn turned this over to various Iraqi banks. But exactly where it went from there, nobody to this day knows.
And, Jim, is it conceivable to you that Chairman Greenspan would not know about the $2.4 billion that on that particular day and the inability to track it afterwards?
We're speculating on this, but just based on what he said, it sounds to us that he did not know about this. But again, as I think Naomi made the point earlier, and we certainly made it in the article, this is not exactly a secret. There's a substantial amount of documentation out there about those transfers. They're listed by day, and that's why we were able to make the statement of the $2.4 billion transfer on that June day back in 2004. That was the largest single transfer of currency in the history of the New York Fed, and indeed in the history of any branch of the Federal Reserve. So,
how could Alan Greenspan, who at the time was the head of the Federal Reserve, not know about this transfer?
Your guess is as good as ours on this one.
But I think an even bigger issue here, Amy, is that Alan Greenspan always speaks with great authority, often on areas and subjects he really doesn't have much knowledge in, but yet he has never, ever, when he was head of the Federal Reserve, was very seldom challenged. And this is one case in which he's put his foot in his mouth, because the Federal Reserve did indeed do all of the things that were attributed to them in the article. And there's nothing, as Jim indicated, there's a record of this. And there were also, I mean, there were a lot of emails back and forth between the Federal Reserve and the various agencies of the U.S. government. So the record is voluminous here. And for Mr. Greenspan to suggest it's something that there were confusing dinars and dollars is really disingenuous.
And Don Bartlett, what about the company that was supposed to be monitoring this money, North Star, that you wrote about in your piece?
This is a really important one, and maybe a little historical perspective. If you go back to the 1990s, there was a mutual fund, so to speak, in the Bahamas called Evergreen Security, which was selling its certificates around the world, especially in the U.S. Chicago school teacher emptied out a retirement fund and invested the entire amount in that. Well, Evergreen Security had been run, for the most part, by Patrick Thompson, a resident of the Bahamas, for a long time. And it was nothing more than a Ponzi scheme. And in the end, more than $200 million disappeared. Well, it was to Mr. Thompson that this mysterious Thomas Heil in La Jolla, California, turned to create a company for him called North Star. And a few years later, lo and behold, North Star is retained by the Pentagon to make sure the money in Iraq, the $12 billion and billions more, does not go missing, which, of course, it did go missing.
When we looked into the background of North Star, come to find out, this is not your normal accounting or auditing operation. Operates out of a private house in a suburb of San Diego. All attempts to interview the individual, Thomas Howell, who apparently heads North Star, failed. He would talk to us a couple times, but said that his hands were tied. The Pentagon would have to give him approval to talk, and they did not. We looked into other aspects of the operation out of this house. Turns out some of it's home improvement. One is supposedly international financial consulting, all very vague, all very, very mysterious. But what does it say to us about the way, in part, we run this war over there, that the Pentagon and the Coalition Provisional Authority turned to a company whose ostensible, one of its functions, running out of that address, is home remodeling, to supervise what's going to happen to billions of dollars being airlifted from this country to Iraq? It may be almost a metaphor for the way we run that whole operation over there.
And were you ever able to trace the way or the connection between these individuals at North Star and the contracting agencies in the government that gave them this contract?
No, the only thing that is crystal clear, and Paul Bremer insisted that this was a Pentagon arrangement and that he had no say over this whatsoever, and that North Star was basically a creature of the Pentagon in terms of supposedly tracking this money. And again, you're talking about a company set up by a person involved in a $200 million stock scam. It just raises all kinds of questions, you know, as to why the Pentagon would utilize such a resource.
So you have an accounting firm created by a mysterious La Jolla man, by an equally mysterious Bahama resident who specializes in setting up offshore entities used to launder money, concealing assets, avoiding taxes, a man who presided over a securities firm from which $200 million was disappeared. Don Bartlett and Jim Steele, we already talked to you about this in our previous piece. How has the press followed up on this expose in Vanity Fair? Don.
This is interesting. I mean, North Star, the company's identity was hanging out there. It's been hanging out there for a long time. But basically, no one has looked at it. And And it goes beyond the news media. It also goes to the heart of congressional investigating committees, of government nobody's interested. And that really raises red flags in our mind as to why you wouldn't be curious about a company assigned the task of making sure billions don't disappear, and they disappear.
Well, Don Barlin, Jim Steele, I want to thank you very much for being with us, for doing the piece in Vanity Fair, and for all of your work, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalistic team speaking to us from Philadelphia. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we go back 40 years to the death of Che Guevara. Stay with us. Aprendimos a quererte, comandante,
revolucionario. Yo. Querido comandante, ¿qué te digo? Primero, mucho gusto, me llamo Rodrigo. Soy un producto del exilio, es el año 2005. Mis padres te seguían y yo sigo en lo mismo. Tu foto en mi casa, me recuerdo tu sonrisa. Un hijo de mi dicta, tu imagen en mi mente. Palabra consecuente, juventud rebelde. Comandante, compañero, guerrillero, hombre nuevo, médico del pueblo. Mi amigo, te respeto, eres modelo ejemplario. Eres legendario y tú me enseñaste, todo se vive a lo diario. Es lo día a día, es lo cotidiano, come on.
Aprendimos a quererte, comandante Che Guevara, hasta la muerte, Che Guevara, con mi gente,
revolucionario. Querido comandante, desde Chicago, con mucho gusto te escribe Gonzalo. Con mi hermano hemos crecido con tu historia, toda la gloria. ¿Cómo sería si estuvieras vivo ahora? Hombre nuevo, a veces siento que no puedo pelear contra el sistema sin apoyo de mi pueblo. Bueno, la verdad es que hay poca resistencia dentro del país donde tengo residencia. 20 años en el ojo del huracán, país más rico en la historia y todavía hay desigualdad.
Comandante by Red Stars here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Today marks the 40th anniversary of the death of one of the most influential figures of the last century, Latin American revolutionary Ernesto Che Guevara. Born in Argentina in 1928, Che rose to international prominence as one of the key leaders of the 1959 Cuban Revolution that overthrew dictator Fulgencio Batista. After a period in the new Cuban government leadership, Che aimed to spark revolutionary activity internationally. In 1965, he led a secret Cuban operation aiding and training rebels in the Congo. 1 year later, Che was in Bolivia, helping to lead an uprising against the U.S.-backed government. On October 8, 1967, he was captured by Bolivian troops working with the CIA. He was executed 1 day later. Commemorations are underway today in Cuba, Bolivia, and around the world. Some 10,000 people turned out Monday for a ceremony in Santa Clara, Cuba. Che's daughter, Aleida Guevara, addressed the crowd.
I want to remember the commitment we all have in order to make our society stronger. Today, Latin America is starting to wake up and make all of our dreams come true. We have to be present and firmer than ever. That is the greatest homage we can make to our fathers and our loved ones.
Aleida Guevara, daughter of Che Guevara, speaking Monday in Havana. In a moment, we'll be joined by Latin American historian Greg Gangan. But first, Che in his own words. This is an excerpt of Che's address to the United Nations in December 1964.
Bestialidad.
The bestiality of imperialism, a bestiality that knows no limits, that has no national frontiers. The bestiality of Hitler's armies is like the North American bestiality, like that of Belgian paratroopers and that of French imperialists in Algeria. For it is the very essence of imperialism to turn men into wild, bloodthirsty animals, determined to slaughter, kill, murder, and destroy the very last vestige of the image of the revolutionary or the partisan in any regime that they crush under their boots because it fights for freedom. The statue of Lumumba, destroyed today but rebuilt tomorrow, reminds us of this tragic story, of this martyr of the world revolution, and makes sure that we will never trust imperialism in no way at all, not an iota.
Pero ni tantito así. Nada.
Che Guevara speaking to the UN General Assembly December 11, 1964. Just days later, a group of journalists interviewed Che at the Cuban mission in New York. The legendary reporter from Pacifica, Chris Koch, was among that group. This is a rare excerpt of the press conference, beginning with Koch's introduction.
This is Chris Koch. On Wednesday night, December 16th, a group of American socialist journalists and writers spent about an hour talking with Comandante Che Guevara at the Cuban mission here in New York. I was there with a microphone and tape recorder, and this program will be a report of that meeting with the Cuban Minister of Industry. East 67th Street between Madison and Fifth Avenue was blocked off by barricades and a handful of policemen. The group of writers who had met at a restaurant in the neighborhood were stopped by police at the corner. We waited until clearance came from the Cuban Mission building near the center of the block, then walked into a large townhouse through a tight line of New York's finest, making comments and nudging us as we tried to get through the door. We waited in a storeroom for about a half an hour and then went upstairs, into a large room with a high ceiling, a desk, a marble fireplace, chandeliers, and three sofas, partially surrounding a large coffee table. The writers ranged themselves on the sofa, and Comandante Guevara knelt on the floor in front of the table. Those standing soon settled down on the floor around the table next to him. Comandante Guevara was dressed in pressed military fatigues and polished black boots. During the conversation, he was in constant motion, lying on his side, shifting to a squatting position, back to his side, resting his head on his hands, and puffing constantly on a cigar. Constant motion. Guevara was relaxed, joked much, smiled always. One area of the discussion dealt with his own revolutionary past, and his analysis of the Cuban guerrilla struggle.
You are Argentinian by birth, and rather than make a revolution in the Argentine, you went out and, as I understand it, traveled and stayed in several countries before coming into conjunction with Fidel Castro in Mexico. I would like to ask how you look back upon this and see it as some kind of lucky juncture, or that somehow you've were searching until a revolutionary situation coalesced, or?
Bueno, es una pregunta más bien de intimidad, así de círculo, después de tres o cuatro coñac y remembranza de otras cosas.
It seems to be a question to be answered after three or four drinks in a more intimate atmosphere.
En general, lo que se puede decir,
in general, what we can, could say,
que hay algunos momentos,
there are some moments
de nuestra revolución,
in our revolution,
que son cosas de loco,
that are things completely mad.
El ataque a Moncada,
the attack against the Moncada barracks,
la salida en el Grama,
the expedition of the Grama.
La continuación de la lucha con el grupo de hombres que era.
The struggle with the handful of men that remained.
La defensa contra la última embestida de la dictadura en la sierra.
The defense against the last great attack of, by the dictatorship in the Sierra Maestra.
La invasión de las villas.
The invasion of the province of Las Villas.
La toma de las principales ciudades.
The seizure of the principal towns.
Cada una de esas cosas se analiza.
If you analyze one, each one of those things,
y se llega a la conclusión de que había loco de por medio.
You reach the conclusion that there was something mad in the middle, something crazy in the middle.
Y como todas ellas concatenadas llevaron a la toma del poder.
And as all of them, as a chain, led to the seizure of power.
Tal vez se podría llegar a la conclusión de que para tomar el poder se necesita ser un poco loco.
You may have to reach the conclusion that in order to seize power you have to be a little crazy.
An excerpt of a rare interview with Che Guevara, December 11, 1964, from the Pacifica Radio Archive. Greg Grandin joins us now, professor of Latin American history at New York University, author of Empire's Workshop, Latin America, the United States, and the Rise of the New Imperialism, just out in paperback. Talk about how Che Guevara, an Argentine, ends up leading with Fidel Castro the Cuban Revolution.
Well, it's an interesting story, and what makes Che so iconic is that his life embodies the revolutionary century of Latin America. And a lot of your listeners may know, what viewers may be aware of Che's motorcycle diary trip, where he toured around Latin America, and through that he developed a consciousness, a Pan-American consciousness. Well, right after that trip, he wound up in Guatemala, which was undergoing a profound democratic revolution between 1944 and 1954. Guatemala was one of the most ambitious social democratic revolutions that emerged throughout Latin America after World War II. And what's important about Guatemala is that by 1948, 1950, most democratic revolutions in Latin America had been rolled back, or there was a wave of reaction throughout the continent. But in Guatemala, the revolution actually deepened. And Che spent 1953, wound up in Guatemala, landed in Guatemala in 1953, and he lived through the counter-revolution. This was the United States' first CIA-orchestrated coup in Latin America. Against Jacobo Arbenz, United Fruit Company, defending the interests of the United Fruit Company.
So first the U.S. CIA had overthrown Iran in 1953, then trying to use the same model goes...
Well, it was actually even more ambitious. Iran was a pretty fast operation, a couple of weeks. Guatemala was the most extensive and ambitious CIA operation to date. It utilized every aspect of U.S. power, not just military and economic and political, but a whole broad array of psychological destabilization campaigns.
Quite a bit of penetration of the Guatemalan press as well beforehand to prepare the way for the coup as well.
Exactly, that's what I mean. It was really, it became the model for other coups in which the United States would destabilize the civil society organizations, the press.
John Foster Dulles was the head of the State Department at the time. Formerly, he was the corporate lawyer for United Fruit.
Right.
On behalf of whom Guatemala was overthrown.
Yes. The United Fruit Company had some land expropriated, and the United States was concerned about the legalization of the Communist Party. And what's important in terms of Che is that he witnessed this. He was in Guatemala. He developed more of a revolutionary consciousness. He worked as a socially committed doctor ministering to the country's poor in a clinic. And he saw the overthrow of what was the longest lasting post-war democracy in Latin America firsthand. He had to flee to took asylum in the Argentine embassy. It was in the embassy, he spent a few months, and he met a number of future revolutionaries, Guatemalan new left-armed revolutionaries. And then he managed to flee, receive exile in Mexico, and that's where he met Fidel Castro and joined the Cuban Revolution and went on to make history. But Guatemala had a deep impact on him. He would go on to justify the closing down, the suppressing of civil liberties in Cuba and the radicalization of the revolution in Cuba by saying that Cuba will not be another Guatemala. In many ways, Guatemala, much more than Cuba. Diplomatic historians love to focus on Cuba. They think the Cold War began and ended in Cuba. But it was really Guatemala that was much more of a turning point, not just in Che's life, but for a whole generation of Latin American reformers and nationalists and Democrats. It led to a deep radicalization and a sense that democracy and reform would not come about through an alliance with the national bourgeoisie and national progressive capitalist class. It was witnessing the downfall of the Guatemalan democracy in which elites did ally with the CIA and the U.S. that led to a much more radical understanding of how to bring about social change and the Cuban Revolution. What's also important about the overthrow of Arbenz is that it became a model, as Juan mentioned, for the Bay of Pigs operation. And because of the success, or the easy success, seemingly easy success of the overthrow of Arbenz, CIA got a bit confident, and a lot of many of the assumptions that they, the lessons that they thought they learned from Guatemala, they applied in the Bay of Pigs. Of course, the Bay of Pigs was a complete disaster that went on to have a much more radicalizing influence throughout the Americas.
Explain the Bay of Pigs, but even how, once Fidel and Che had linked up in Mexico, how they actually launched the revolution, came into Cuba.
Well, they had a yacht, the Granma. It was a ship in which they set out on an expedition. I can't remember the number, but it has become myth that there were 12 that once they landed, they were the Batista's army was waiting for them, and they ambushed them, and a number of the people on the expedition, which I think started with 80 men or something like that, around 80-something, it's become myth that 12 survived. Obviously, that has a certain resonance within the New Testament, and 12 made it into the Sierra Maestra and began to organize, and among them were Che and Fidel, and it was Che developed a reputation, a well-deserved reputation as a military strategist, and he won a number of key battles against Batista's army.
But once the revolution triumphed against Batista, and obviously Cuba was very different in that it had a very large existing labor movement that provided eventually some mass base for the guerrillas as well as those in the countryside. Che then doesn't spend very much time actually constructing the revolution, does he?
No, he's not really a policymaker. He is more of a could be understood as an action intellectual. He was the head of speaking of Alan Greenspan, he was the head of the central bank, Cuban central bank, and minister of the economy of industry. He wanted to go fast. His plan for Cuba was to centralize authority and industrialize as quick as possible. In an island of 8 million people at the time, it didn't 6 million people at the time, that was not a very practical plan. The Soviet, as Cuba became closer to the Soviet Union, became clear that they weren't going to industrialize. And there was some divisions. Historians debate just to what degree there was rivalry within the Cuban Revolution between Fidel and Che. But Che's giving up his formal position within the Cuban government, and he toured the United States, and then he went to Africa to join a guerrilla movement in the Congo, and that was a failure. And then from there he went to Bolivia.
There he met Laurent Kabila, who became the head of the Congo. But I wanted to go to Bolivian President Evo Morales. Juan and I interviewed him on Democracy Now! Just a few weeks ago when he came to New York for the UN General Assembly. President Morales spoke about Che's legacy 40 years after his death.
Yo primero veo, seguramente la década, tal vez 40, no tenía vida todavía, 50, 60. Yo siento que por entonces los pueblos levantaban armas contra el imperio.
First of all, in the 40s, in the 50s, in the 60s, of course, when I hadn't been born yet, my first perception is that people rose up in arms to struggle against the empire.
Ahora veo todo lo contrario.
Now I see quite the opposite.
Es el imperio quien levanta armas contra los pueblos.
It's the empire that's raising up arms against the peoples.
Yo siento que por entonces los pueblos que se organizaban
What I think is that
en busca
then,
de justicia, the, igualdad,
that the peoples that got organized and struggled looking for justice,
y ahora,
for equality.
Las transformaciones profundas se hacen en democracia.
And now I think that these transformations, these structural transformations, are being forged through democracies.
Desde estos dos puntos de vista, pues Che Guevara sigue siendo un símbolo que dio su vida por los pueblos.
And from these two points of view, Che Guevara continues to be a symbol of someone who gave his life for the people.
Cuando en Latinoamérica y en Bolivia imperaban las dictaduras militares.
When in Bolivia and in other countries around the world reigned military dictatorships.
Y no se puede entender después de 40 años el Che está en todo el mundo.
And so that's why it's amazing to see that all over the world Che Guevara is still there 40 years later.
Pero ahora estamos en otros tiempos. Valorar ese pensamiento, esa lucha.
But now we're living other times. But to value and recognize that thinking, that struggle.
Y si valoramos, no es para seguir los pasos con un levantamiento armado.
And if we recognize it and we value it, that doesn't mean it means to mechanically follow the steps that he took in terms of military uprising.
That is the Bolivian president, Evo Morales, particularly significant because that is where Che Guevara died 40 years ago today. Professor Greg Grandin, talk about his death. Who was there? Who ordered his killing?
Well, his debate about who ordered his killing, who was there, was Felix Rodriguez, a CIA agent. In many ways, if Che embodied the hopes and aspirations of the revolutionary left of Latin America, Felix Rodriguez embodied, it was the anti-Che in many ways. He embodied the hopes of the counter-revolutionary Latin American half-century. He was a Cuban from a wealthy Cuban family who fled the revolution, went to Miami, participated in an invasion of Cuba prior to the Bay of Pigs, and was picked up by the CIA. And he did advance work for the CIA for the Bay of Pigs invasion. And he managed to he got the nickname Lazarus because he managed to survive the Bay of Pigs somehow and get out of Cuba. He went on to participate in almost every counterinsurgent scandal that we know of. He was deeply involved in Iran-Contra and in the drugs running drugs into the U.S. to fund the Contras. He was involved in the Phoenix program in Vietnam, which was basically a CIA-run death squad operation. And he was put in charge in 1967 of hunting Che in Bolivia. And there's some debate. Che entered Bolivia in late 1966, and after meeting some success with a small band of guerrillas, they began to run into problems, and they became increasingly isolated in the highlands of Bolivia. And Felix Rodriguez was working closely with Bolivian military and security personnel, and they captured him in October 8th, 1967, and executed him on October 9th. Rodriguez claims that he wanted Che alive, and there's some debate about this, and it's perfectly feasible that the U.S. did want to interrogate Che. But what's interesting and ironic about the execution of Che is that Rodriguez claims that even though he had orders from the U.S. to keep Che alive, that the Bolivian government and the Bolivian military on the ground had direct orders from the Bolivian high command that they had to execute him. And Rodriguez claims that since they were on foreign territory, they had to honor Bolivian sovereignty. Now, this must have been one time in U.S. history where they actually honored Latin American sovereignty in the case of executing somebody who was fighting for Latin American sovereignty.
He went on to be close to President George H.W. Bush, his national security advisor, Donald Gregg, when he was vice president. Pictures of him at the White House, yeah, together with him, is now doing interviews in Miami, proudly talking about taking down Che in the final picture when Che thought he was going to live, but Felix Rodriguez, they took the picture and then said, now you will die.
Yeah, and he did go on to be close with Bush, and this was involvement in Iran-Contra. Bush obviously was the head of the CIA, and that's what he developed close contacts with Bush and Gregg. Iran-Contra, he was involved in along with Luis Posada, another Cuban terrorist. They were in charge of running military supplies to the Contras illegally. The Cuban Revolution radicalized both sides in many ways and produced generations of revolutionaries and counter-revolutionaries.
We're going to go to break, then come back to this discussion. Our guest is Professor Gregg Grandin, professor of Latin American history at NYU. His book, Empire's Workshop. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Vengo cantando esta samba con redoble libertario. Mataron al guerrillero Che, comandante Guevara. Selvas, pampas y montañas, patria o muerte su destino. Selvas, pampas y montañas, patria o muerte su destino. Que los derechos humanos los violan en tantas partes, en América Latina, domingo, lunes y martes. Nos imponen militares para sojuzgar los pueblos, dictadores, asesinos, gorilas y generales.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, Gregg Grandin, our guest, author of Empire's Workshop, Latin America, the United States, and the Rise of the New Imperialism. Che Guevara, his legacy, and what it means for all of Latin America right now.
Well, as your report suggested, there's celebrations and commemorations all over Latin America, indeed all over the world. And Che Guevara has become an icon of the Latin American left. And in many ways, he's much more celebrated and honored today than he was during while he was alive. While he was alive, the Cuban Revolution symbolized something of a break between the old communist-based Latin American left with its emphasis on reform and compromise and a new revolutionary armed left. And there were many divisions and controversies and fights and sectarian fights while he was alive. But now he's become a universal symbol of the Latin American left. And if you look at his legacy has produced the Latin American left, which is profoundly democratic, profoundly humanist. You look at going back to Felix Rodriguez, you look at the legacy of Rodriguez, and the legacy of counterinsurgency in Latin America leads straight to the torture rooms of Abu Ghraib. So you just compare those two, and you have a sense of what Che's legacy is in Latin America. Che is a symbol, and again, he's become more of a universal symbol of a certain different kinds of values than what he represented while he was alive. Those values are anti-imperialism, standing up to the United States, defense of Latin American sovereignty, a certain kind of revolutionary purity, a search for values that aren't rooted in the marketplace, that aren't quite as commodified as the neoliberal world that has been imposed on Latin America in the last 20 years. So this is why I think Che has become such an enduring icon of Latin American Democrats.
But I have questions about the iconic stature to the degree that, I mean, it's very much like Malcolm. It's suddenly everyone was wearing Malcolm T-shirts after the Spike Lee movie. But to what degree the young people who are see him as an icon, really understand the struggles, the real struggles that he represented, rather than just sort of the fashionable rebellion.
Yeah, and the New York Times today had an article about even in Cuba, his image is being commodified to some degree on keychains and T-shirts and raising revenue for the state. But again, I think they may not understand the specifics of the struggle or the specifics of the strategy and different the currents within Marxism that he represented, but I think that beyond just a commodified image of revolutionary chic, particularly in Latin America, he does represent a certain kind of non-commodified value, standing up to the U.S. And you know, I was in Guatemala when the war ended in 1996 officially, and all of a sudden his image was everywhere in Guatemala. This is a country, probably one of the most repressed countries, arguably still is in Latin America. And here Che was, who was no fan of free speech in Cuba, becomes an icon of exactly that in Guatemala. So,
the other concern is also that I have is in terms of how that legacy is analyzed. I think President Morales said something very interesting when in the interview we had with him, when he had a meeting with Fidel Castro a few years before he was elected president, and Fidel told him, "Don't do what I did. Do what Chavez did." In essence, don't see how you can mobilize the people to achieve constitutional change and transform the society through democratic methods.
And I think that's a great example of how adaptable and evolutionary the legacy is in the Latin American left. You know, Che is held up by those always on the hunt for, you know, any kind of residual sympathy of the militant new left as the person, or the Cuban Revolution as the event which inflamed a continent. But that inflammation actually started with the Guatemalan overthrow with the CIA overthrow of Guatemalan democracy. And that's what inflamed a continent. And there's many reasons why the Latin American left embraced armed revolution in the 1960s. But the fact that it's managed to evolve into the kind of democratic, and again, it's one of the few bright spots in the, not just in Latin America, but in the geopolitical landscape, landscape racked by wars and fundamentalism. The Latin American left is one of the, and the fact that they've adopted a talisman of insurrection, it shows just how adaptable that icon has become.
Well, let's talk about where Latin America is today. At the break, we played Victor Jara, the song Zamba El Che. Victor Jara killed right after September 11th, 1973, when Pinochet rose to power. Now, Michelle Bachelet was in New York, the Chilean ambassador who herself, the Chilean president who herself was tortured with her mother, her father killed under Pinochet. He died of a heart attack. He was a general. Where is Latin America, based on what it's come out of? 67, he dies. 73, Pinochet rises to power. You've got the brutality in Salvador and Guatemala through the 70s.
Yeah, well, Latin America right now is, and then beyond the brutality of that, of Reagan's Central American crusade in the 1980s, 1990s, you see the imposition of neoliberalism, free market radicalism on Latin America, which produced staggering levels of inequality and economic stagnation. And what you're seeing is an attempt to break free of that. There's a lot of divisions among the Latin American left between a reformist, a moderate reformist like Bachelet, or somebody like Chavez, more willing to mobilize a populist base in order to confront capital. But I think they all share a common agenda, and that is breaking free, at least as to the degree possible, of U.S. influence through diversifying markets, deepening integration among Latin American nations, looking for other sources of credit and capital. And all of this is a far cry from Che and Fidel urging the youth of the world to throw off the shackles of imperialism. But I think you can trace a connection between what Che was trying to do and what this new generation of reformers are doing.
They also share a common sense that the government and the state have a responsibility to affect the social life of the population.
So yeah, and that's the most profound, I think, rejection of neoliberalism and the Washington consensus. You know, in many ways, neoliberalism is not dead in Latin America. There's still this, you can make the case that it's as strong as ever. But there is a return, there's a kind of attempt to rebroaden the definition of democracy to mean not just a narrow version of political liberties and freedoms, but to include some kind of social component. In some ways, that goes back to Che's youth. You know, Che coming out of growing up in the 1940s, 30s, and 40s, the definition of democracy was much broader in Latin America than it is now. It included not just individual liberties and political freedoms, but some form of social equality and wealth redistribution. And in some ways, that's the Washington Consensus and the terror of the Cold War followed by the Washington Consensus was an attempt to redefine the notion of democracy and narrow it down, make it much more restrictive, a kind of free market version of democracy. And what you're seeing now is an attempt, a fight to broaden that definition of democracy to include social rights, some form of wealth redistribution. And that's what I think is shared, even among the most reformist, and even, frankly, even some of the more conservative Latin American leaders share that vision.
Back to this day, 40 years ago, in Bolivia, Che Guevara is killed. His reported last words, "I know you've come to kill me. Shoot, you are only going to kill a man." It took some 30 more years or more to even find his bones and then have his corpse returned to Cuba. Talk about the significance of that. John Lee Anderson, the author who wrote about Che, interviewing the general who just in an offhand way happened to say, "Oh, yes, we buried him under the airport here."
Yeah, and in many ways, the current Che never, the celebration and honor of Che never went away. But in some ways, this current revival really did start with that repatriation of his remains back to Cuba. And that also corresponded with the resurrection and reemergence of a Latin American left. Those two things marked each other. In some ways, one inaugurated the other. So it's interesting. But there's another legacy that was reported on in the Latin American press. I don't know, it didn't get much attention here, is that the person who actually did who killed Che, actually pulled the trigger, he's a Bolivian, and he's still alive, and he just recently received a cataract operation in a clinic that was built by Cuban doctors, that was staffed by Cuban doctors. So that, I think, is that captures the legacy of Che right there. Very
we will
nicely.
Leave it there. I want to thank you very much, Greg Grandin, for joining us. His book is called Empire's Workshop: Latin America, the United States, and the Rise of the New Imperialism. You, together with Juan Gonzalez, Cheza Boudin, and Tarek Ali, will be at the Brecht Forum tonight at 6:30 talking about the significance of Che Guevara. Tarek Ali will also join you. We'll have on our broadcast tomorrow. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Shrifo Dukaduce, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Ricardo Lobo, Perry Mache, Kizzy Cox, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Hugh Grant, Hani Massoud, Samantha Chambly, John Randolph, Kieran Krug Meadows, Laura Chipley, Vesta Godars, our website, democracynow.org. There you can get our headlines and stories. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.